Hey, before we get into the lesson on Psalm 147 and the water and the ice that it mentions there, I want to thank several of you last week who encouraged me to see the movie God's Not Dead. I did see it Friday night. And, you know, the fellow who is behind it all, Rice Brooks, wrote a book with the same title, God's Not Dead, and consulted with me on the book. And, you know, he was not the producer of the movie, but had definitely a hand in it. I mean, he was credited as the one who provided the apologetics content for that movie. And I've been kind of remiss, because Rice wrote me quite a while ago saying, look, I want to send you the movie, I want you to watch it, see if you can endorse it. And I've been so busy, I've not been able to respond. You know, I got a book contract I'm working on right now, so literally every minute I got, whether I'm standing in a bank line or whatever, I'm writing that book. So it was rather difficult to get some time away. But thanks to your encouragements, I did go see it. And in fact, we're going to be posting a review on our website at reasons.org on Monday. But I thought I'd just read to you what's going to go up on our website. So, and by the way, the movie has done really well. Nobody was expecting it to break even. It's more than breaking even. Broke even in just the first week. In fact, I think it's ranking now as a number 5 grossing movie. After the first week, they increased by 50% the number of theaters that are showing it. It's gotten some really bad reviews, mainly from unbelievers that are part of the media. But people who have seen it, the reviews are about 95% positive. And, and also the younger creationists have really given it a very negative review. But after I saw the movie, I could see why they gave it such a negative review. Mainly because they used a lot of the apologetics from Reasons to Believe. So, my wife was with me, and, you know, she's a writer. And she kept saying throughout the movie, they really needed a scriptwriter. They really needed a scriptwriter. Because the characters were quite extreme, to say the least. But, I think would have really made the movie a lot better if they'd shown the court case credits at the very beginning. Because when I saw that at the very end, I said, now I understand why they did the movie the way they did. And it would have made a whole lot of difference for me, maybe not for others, if I had seen that first. Well, at the very end, before they rolled the credits, they rolled about 15, 16 court cases where, you know, Christians had been, mistreated or persecuted for their Christian faith on university campuses. And I was reading them as fast as I could and realized I knew quite a few of those people, especially the professors. And then I recognized, okay, what was going on in the movie is the characters that were portrayed were composites. They basically took these court cases. Because, you know, I talked to Rice Brooks, and he says, yeah, this is really based on things that really did happen. But what they did is they took four or five different situations and kind of packed it all into one character. And, you know, my wife, the writer, was saying, that never works. And I had to agree with her. That probably wasn't a good idea. You're better off sticking with one real character rather than trying to pull together composites. But let me read what we're going to put up on our website. And if some of you got comments, go ahead. Okay, a movie by Christians and for Christians, God's Not Dead, has done remarkably well at the box office. Kathy and I saw the film Friday evening, April 4th, which I think was about the 8th or 9th day after it had been released. I only saw 3 empty seats in the entire theater. It was packed. No great detective skills were needed to discern that our fellow viewers were mostly, if not exclusively, fellow Christians. The chorus of cheers and moans, even some amens at appropriate moments, seemed a pretty clear giveaway. In fact, from what I could tell, the audience was at least half youth groups from different churches. Okay, next paragraph. The plot hinges on the response of a Christian freshman student, Josh, to the sneering challenge of his atheist philosophy professor, Dr. Radisson. On a positive note, I was pleased to see that Josh begins his presentation with evidences from the origin of the universe, specifically from Big Bang cosmology. the depiction of Radisson's response, a carefully chosen quotation from Stephen Hawking's book, The Grand Design, fits the reality I've sometimes experienced. Josh's reply is exactly as I had hoped, not an emotional argument or comeback, but rather a tacit acknowledgement for the need for more study. His return to the podium with a counter-quotation from Oxford professor John Lennox captures his class's attention and sets the stage for the next point, the question of life's origin of life and the plausibility of naturalism and the origin of human beings. These categories of evidences can and often are effective in opening dialogue with adults who have little exposure to the Bible or Christianity, so I'm glad they became part of the script. In fact, when Rice was consulting with me, I said, there are four categories of scientific evidences that always, consistently prove to be the most effective: the origin of the universe, the design of the universe, the origin of life, and the origin of humanity. So I'm pleased that that did get into the movie. Next paragraph. While a number of Christian reviewers have complained that the apologetics content in the movie is weak or superficial, my reaction is more forgiving. A movie is entertainment, not a lecture. I mean, if they had actually given the apologetics, it would have been really good to put in the movie. I don't think people would want to see the movie. It would be a lecture, not a movie. I felt satisfied that the movie raised some of the most important apologetics topics. In-depth equipping and evangelistic content may be found in abundance elsewhere. As for the character portrayals in the movie, most were extreme, unrealistic, and certainly not believable. Although the movie listed over a dozen court cases, some resolved and others still pending, arising from real incidents on university campuses where Christian students and faculty were treated unjustly, only a couple I know about personally came close to the outrageous circumstances depicted, and there are cases in which faculty, not students, were treated badly. I mean, there's kind of a fine line in the university campus. You can treat your fellow faculty a lot more harshly than you can students. And in fact, no matter whether you got tenure or not, if anyone behaved like that Dr. Radisson, they would have been fired on the spot. So, and that's understood on the university campus. However, I do know Christian faculty who have been treated as badly as Josh was treated by unbelievers on the campus. Now, moving on. The portrayal of the pastor also disturbed me. He seemed ambivalent and aloof. On the other hand, I thought that was really real. A lot of students who are really facing a challenge on the university campus come to their pastors for help, and they don't get any help. They get a pat on the back. Here's a Bible verse. And in that sense, I thought this was real, because that's how a lot of pastors would need respond. So, it would have been nice if the pastor had been a little more pastoral, but in that sense, I thought they got it right. That's basically how a lot of pastors ministering to university students respond. So, and I did see a few emotionally authentic, impactful scenes. I saw several, actually. I'm going to mention two. Two that stand out to me include the one in which the Islamic father weeps bitterly after striking his daughter and shoving her out the front door. Both his sorrow and hers seemed real. Another is the scene in which the woman suffering from dementia suddenly speaks with profound clarity and spiritual insight. Such experiences may be rare, but I've actually witnessed them. I've seen that quite frequently with people who are suffering from dementia. Suddenly, they speak with as if they had incredible intellect, but it's always on some spiritual topic. I got to see that my mother-in-law, when she was 4 years in dementia, but she'd have these moments where she couldn't talk a word to us, but something out of the Bible would just come straight out of her mouth. And so in that sense, I thought the scene was great. The triumphalist attitude the Christian student expresses toward his professor, not to mention his aggressive pressing of his case, bothered me more than any other weakness of the film. It's certainly true that many atheists rely on intellectual smokescreens to hide deep wounds that embitter them towards God. However, most atheists in such situations will not discuss their personal reasons for rejecting God unless their intellectual objections are addressed and treated with respect. On the other hand, I thought the portrayal of the student Josh, again, was real. I can't tell you how many times I've been in university campuses and you get these young students behaving in a very prideful and triumphalist way in dealing with their faculty and fellow students. So in that sense, they were trying to portray reality. But what bothered me is the fact that everybody in the audience was cheering and clapping when Josh put it to his professor and says, well, wait a minute. This is actually a character flaw that's being portrayed here in the movie. It's an accurate portrayal flaw, a very common one, but it's not one that we Christians in the audience should be rejoicing over. This is really not the way to treat non-Christians that are struggling with these issues. They seem especially, talking again about, however, most atheists in such situations will not discuss their personal reasons for rejecting God unless their intellectual objections are addressed and treated with respect. In my experience is you've got to literally remove all their intellectual objections before they're willing to reveal the hurts and injuries they've experienced in the past from believers or so-called believers. They seem especially reluctant to do so publicly, especially the Christian badgers. And that was kind of the thing that was being portrayed, this young student, you know, going after his professor in front of a class of 80 students. It happens. I've seen it. But that's really not the way to try to minister. You want to do that privately, just the two of you. I mean, I got to see that when I was speaking at Iowa State University. There was an atheist professor there who was very rude towards me. But eventually I was able to talk to him privately, just one-on-one with nobody else around. And then things began to open up. As an audience, it really doesn't work. I'm convinced that deeply personal reasons should always be addressed privately in a spirit of grace, compassion, and humility. If you can't actually express some compassion towards the hurts that the individual has experienced, you're not going to get very far. I must add, too, that I've met some atheists whose barriers really are intellectual. I mean, the trip I talked to you about when I went to Texas, almost 200 people there. They were atheists, but they were atheists simply because they had intellectual questions that no one had been able to answer. As soon as they were answered, they responded publicly and gave their lives to Christ. And my particular position is always assume the best. Assume that the atheist you're talking to doesn't have a rebellion problem, doesn't have some kind of wound or bitter hurt, but simply has intellectual questions that need to be answered. And if you answer them and they respond, then you know that's all that's taken care of. I've met some atheists whose barriers really are intellectual. Once their questions about how the Bible and the facts of nature and history fit together, they are ready and eager to give their life to Christ. We Christians should never presume antagonism or animosity beyond natural resistance to a faith surrender until we see evidence otherwise. The movie did remind me to pray for the individuals, organizations, and situations listed at the movie's end, and especially for the Christians involved, that they do display the character of Christ, and I would add the character of Daniel, in their approach to appealing to those in authority. Do I think Christians should see the movie? Yes, I do. And for the same reason, I think they should consider seeing the far more deeply flawed depiction of Noah, the movie by that name. Viewing God's Not Dead may provide believers with opportunities for conversation about our faith and about what the Bible does or does not teach. It may also provide opportunities to discover what questions non-believers are asking, questions we need to be prepared to address with gentleness, with respect, and a clear conscience. And to me, that was the best part of the movie. They raised the most important questions. And my prayer is that Christians watching the movie will say, you know, I need to get good answers to those questions that were there. The movie didn't give you good answers, but the movie basically said the answers are out there. So, and that's why Rice Brooks wrote his book, God Is Not Dead, is to try to lay out the answers in more detail. And he's obviously not a scientist. He said these are some places you can go to get more detailed answers beyond that. Yes.
I thought he was very respectful, very much like you personally. And I think that he was presenting a case. This is like a trial. And so he had to appeal to all of those kids there, and even though the audience was clapping, he had to kind of not make it, he didn't have the opportunity to make it private. So he had to present his case, and it was beautiful how the one stood up and they got it. You know, a lot of them got it.
Notice that that student from the People's Republic of China is kind of in the category of someone who has intellectual objections only. And when his questions were addressed, he was ready. The professor had some personal issues, and that needed to be addressed privately. And yeah, I do think that the portrayal of the student was commendable for his first two presentations. And by the way, what have made it real is if they'd made that a graduate-level course, because it would be very appropriate for a philosophy professor at a graduate-level course, for example, to say, half the class, you're going to defend the existence of God. The other half of the class are going to defend the non-existence of God. I'm going to grade you on how well you do in your engagement with one another. But yeah, one review I read from a philosophy professor said, what happened in that movie would never happen at the undergraduate level. That's just not done. And also, if you do it at the graduate level, the professor bows out. He does not participate. Even at the graduate level, it's really intimidating to have to, quote, engage your professor. I've done seminar courses at the graduate level, and it was always student on student, never student on professor. Although what was really fun is when we got to sit in as students and watch the professors debate one another. In fact, I can tell you that was probably one of the most productive parts of my graduate education, is actually sitting in the audience and watching professors debate one another. And that's actually becoming a more common teaching style in academia at the graduate level. For example, you can buy a book written by Stephen Hawking and Roger Penrose. And the book is basically the lecture notes from a semester-long course where Stephen Hawking and Roger Penrose, who've been lifelong friends and research partners, written many papers together, they debate one another in front of a class at Cambridge University on the character and existence of God, where Penrose defends a theistic position, and we have Hawking defending a deistic perspective. Neither one of them Christians, but one kind of defends deism, one defends theism. So in that sense, I think it would have been good if Rice Brooks and the others had actually consulted some university professors and people. But I think what happened is they're responding to all these court cases and wanted to do a movie in the court cases. And Rice told me, I don't have total control over this movie. The one who's producing it is really focused on the court cases. Which, again, I think would have been good if that was actually put up right at the front so people can understand the context. So that's my response. And we're going to put this up on our website. And I'm going to let Rice know that, hey, we're not behaving like, because he asked me to endorse the movie, so there is an endorsement in there. And I think I'm especially motivated given how other Christian organizations are basically encouraging a boycott, saying, no, we're not doing that. So, well, the reason why is because the movie is promoting Big Bang cosmology, and the student talked about the universe being 13.8 billion years old. That was enough to set him off. But that's one reason why we got the problem that the movie is portrayed, how people are presenting weaker evidences rather than the kinds of evidences that are going to be effective. We present weak evidences because we're trying not to rock the boat in the church. But if you try too hard not to rock the boat in the church, you don't get to rock the boat outside the church. And that's a boat that needs to be alerted to the fact that there's real evidences for the Christian faith. Okay. Yeah, I got a question?
Court cases you mentioned?
Well, these are court cases where students and student organizations and professors and the graduate Christian organizations have been abused on the university campus. For example, there's cases where a Christian club was not allowed to meet on the university campus. They were told you can meet at the church, but you can't meet here. But the Muslims were allowed to meet. The Hindus were allowed to meet. The atheists were allowed to meet, but Christians couldn't meet. And so a couple lawyers said, you know, that's not right. You're violating freedom of speech. And they took up the court case. By the way, in the movie, most of the court cases listed have been resolved. There's several that are not being resolved. And the ones that are having the greatest difficulty being resolved are those that involve professors, where atheist professors went after a Christian professor and basically abused the rights of that professor. You can't talk about your Christian faith to your fellow, to your students. Well, they listed the universities. I'm trying to remember them off the top of my head. I think you can go to the God's Not Dead website and they'll list them all for you. So, but yeah, one is a professor I went to Russia with during the Soviet era. Very gentle individual, but he told me that he's been abused to an incredible degree by his fellow professors, even to the point where they want to take away his tenure status. They said they won't let him teach classes anymore. So it's like, hey, you know, this is really over the top. And but fortunately, a lawyer has taken up his case, and we'll see how that one goes. So in that sense, I think the movie is right. There is real unjust persecution going on the university campus. But in one sense, I would argue this is evidence for God. Notice that all this persecution is only targeting evangelical Christians. The Muslims are left alone. The Buddhists are left alone. The atheists are left alone. The fact that all this focus is targeting evangelical Christianity means they know that this is actually real. Yeah. Pardon me?
They're the most aggressive, I think.
Oh, I wouldn't say that the evangelical Christians are the most aggressive.
I've never heard of a Muslim going around and saying, hey.
Oh, yes, they do.
Oh, the Muslims are far more aggressive, as are the Mormons. So, yeah. So, yeah, and you know, what's really going on are court cases where you've got a professor who, out of class, is having a Bible study in his office with students who want to come. And basically he's being told he can't do that. He can't talk about his faith in any public way. Students are being told that they can't put a Bible verse on their dorm room door. It's like, wait a minute, this is my dorm. I'm paying rent here. Everybody else gets to put things on their dorm room door. They only single out the evangelical Christians for posting a Bible verse. And I told you the story about David Block, an Orthodox Jew, became a Christian, who he had challenged all of his Jewish relatives, let's all apply to emigrate to Israel. And everybody has to put down their religious affiliation. He put down Christian. His was the only one rejected. And he asked his family, why was mine rejected and all of you were accepted? And his uncle who spoke up and said, we Jews only fear the truth. So, yeah, go ahead.
No intelligence allowed.
Mm-hmm.
They presented some of those teachers, those court cases of teachers.
It's actually a different set. Because, I talked to Rice about that. And the one reason we did not endorse Ben Stein's movie is that the persecution cases were people who were being persecuted for pushing a young earth creationist position in science classrooms.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, the reaction there was, wait a minute, this is on the same level as a flat earth, and, we're not going to let this. And they were being persecuted not for their religious beliefs, but for the science that they were trying to push against. So in this case, they were wise and they were picking court cases that did not involve the young earth creationist doctrine. So I think in that sense they were wiser. Yes.
Are Jews allowed to meet at these universities? You mentioned Muslims and Hindus, not Christians. But are Jews allowed?
I don't know the details. I think it depends what kind of Jew you're talking about. I mean, we know here in the LA area you've got Orthodox Jews, Conservative Jews, and the Reformed Jews, and they're very different in the way they express their beliefs. So, yes.
In many cases, what's understood or portrayed as being a scientist versus a Christian religion is really not that, as you point out in your model. It's really the philosophy of naturalism this man happens to be a Zionist, this person happens to be a Zionist, but it's really his philosophy that's speaking.
Well, that's the thing about us scientists, especially those of us in the physical sciences. We have a hard time trying to see what in our science is science and what is philosophy. So, yeah. Well, I mean, what I saw in the movie was a quote from Richard Dawkins, "Philosophy is dead." Well, that's written by a scientist that doesn't know what philosophy really is.
And as John Lennox points out, he spends two-thirds of his book on philosophy.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what I've noticed about physicists who talk about these issues. They don't realize when they're moving into philosophy and theology. Now, a few do. Where I especially see that is in the science of the search for extraterrestrial intelligent life. They know they're on theological turf, and they'll admit it. In fact, I remember listening to a lecture on the search for extraterrestrial intelligent life, and the guy who was giving the lecture took off his lab coat and put on the garb of a pastor. What do you call those things? Robes. And said, you know, I've now stopped being a scientist, now I'm a theologian. And, you know, but there I think it's so obvious that when you're looking for extraterrestrial intelligent life, that it's not just a scientific issue. Yes?
You know, most of the debates that I've seen, you know, including yours on the Ankerberg show with Ken Ham, the issue of biblical interpretation focuses around the day issue. But really that's not where they come from. It's about the biblical passages of what God calls good when he finished creating.
Well, that's true. In a couple of weeks.
Stumbling blocks that I haven't seen a really good debate yet that focuses on biblical content to address that issue of animal suffering.
Well, I remember one time I debated a professor on the issue of the age of the earth and the universe. And when he had his time to speak, he said, it's not the Bible. It's not the science. It's philosophy. But you're right. I mean, the heart of the young earth position is not what the Bible's got to say. It's the philosophy of whether or not a good God would tolerate the death of plants and animals without it somehow being attached to the sin of human beings. So in that sense, it's a philosophical debate.
But I've not seen it addressed really in a good debate format for opening up the Bible to see what the Bible teaches about that.
Well, I've done a couple of public debates with young earth creationists where I was able to get the young earth creationists to agree with me that nowhere in the Bible does it say no death before Adam. There's not a single verse in the Old Testament or the New Testament that would say that. And in that sense, their position is not a biblical position, it's a philosophical position. I mean, does it really comport that a good, loving God, all-powerful God, would have plants and animals dying before Adam and Eve sinned? Well, again, I think that's where you could probably get it back to the Bible and say,
yeah,
well,
get it off philosophy and say, what does God say?
Well, that's kind of how I responded in the debate. I just said, well, if you look at the New Testament, throughout the entire New Testament, Gospels as well as Epistles, the message is the only way you can live is to die. Death is a pathway to life. And in that sense, how can we label death as being a fundamental evil? And for that matter, I'll bet you most of you got here by automobiles this morning. You got here by automobiles thanks to the fact that there is 76 quadrillion tons of biodeposits in the crust of the earth. And that takes a lot of death of plants and animals to build up the biodeposits so you can drive to church. So, hey, when we celebrate Thanksgiving, we thank God for all those biodeposits. All right.
But you talking about before the fall, the earth being perfect, it also affects the new creation, your view of that as well. Because most of those young earthers that say it was perfect in the Garden of Eden view the new creation as being a restoration rather than a total recreation. And so it totally affects how you view our eternal state,
right,
as well.
They go to the lion that lays down with the lamb as a new creation, and they really read that as a restored Eden.
But that's the Manila location.
Well,
that's
this is why I would argue what separates us at Reasons to Believe from Answers in Genesis and the Institute for Creation Research isn't so much the age of the earth. is what we think about heaven.
Yes.
And that's a far more important issue to discuss. Mm-hmm. So in our model, the earth is not restored. It's replaced with a new creation. But in their model, Eden is restored.
Right.
And so the promise of humanity is we get to go back to Eden. I'm not too excited about going back to Eden myself. I'd rather go with the picture in Revelation 21 and 22. But it really explains the difference between young earth and old earth, because they actually view the creation before Adam and Eve sinned as being ultimate and perfect. Now, where I do agree with them, I believe it's the perfect creation to be a tool in God's hand to eliminate evil and suffering. But it's not the ultimate creation. The ultimate perfect creation will come in the future. And the other problem is, Adam's not the first sinner. Satan's the first sinner. And the Bible is silent on exactly when Satan sinned. He may have sinned billions of years before Adam sinned. We don't know. Hey, we're a little off topic. So let's get back into the text here. And, we've been thanking God for water for a long time. Psalm 147 is one of the creation psalms. In fact, you can kind of put 147 and 148 together. In the sense of being a text on creation. So it's the last of half a dozen creation psalms we see in that book. But what you see in Psalm 147 with respect to the water, it says in verse 8, God covers the sky with clouds. He supplies the earth with rain and makes grass grow in the hills. He provides food for the cattle and for the young ravens when they call. Verse 16, he spreads out the snow like wool. He scatters the frost like ashes. He hurls down his hail like pebbles. Who can withstand his icy blasts? He sends his word and melts them. He stirs up his breezes and the waters flow. And this is something you see in every creation text in the Bible that talks about the water cycle. Each case it mentions the liquid precipitation and the frozen precipitation. And remember, we all gathered here in the class and broke up into groups of four or five people, and we actually went through the longest text in the Bible that deals with the water cycle, namely Job 37 and Job 38. And what I had you do is identify all the different forms of precipitation that are mentioned in that text. And I'll just read you the list you came up with. In terms of the frozen stuff, snow, hail, frost, ice, and the frozen surface of the deep. In terms of the liquid, rain, dew, mist, fog, showers, downpour, floods of water, torrents of rain, and hurricanes. Now, what we've been talking about here in the classes, you need every one of those if you're going to have advanced life capable of launching global high technology civilization to a degree that humanity can fulfill the Great Commission. So, we can't fulfill the Great Commission unless we have all these different kinds of precipitation. You know, we live in a state where we recognize how valuable it is to have that snow packing on the high Sierras. In fact, really, to sustain the economy here in California, you want about 30 feet of snow falling every winter. That hasn't happened. I think 5 years ago was the last time we had that much snow. I can remember when I first arrived here in California, we would get that much snow on San Gregorio. San Gregorio, you're lucky if you get 5 feet of snow on it now. So, but the whole point is, what makes it possible to have the large population here in California, what makes it possible for California to be the number one food producer for the United States, is that we have all that melting snow that provides water to irrigate the dry plains where we grow all these crops. Crops a year we can grow here because of our warm weather. So we need the snow. And we talked about the hail and the frost. Well, what we're talking about now are the last two items, the ice and the frozen surface of the deep. And so last week we talked about the ice. And what that's referring to is basically glaciers on the land masses and how we're still benefiting from the melting of these glaciers. So we were hinting last week that ice ages are a critical feature to make advanced life possible here on the Earth. If you don't have ice ages, you do not have adequate melt of these big glaciers to feed the rivers so that we can have agriculture, abundant cultivation on all the land masses of the Earth. And so if you look at North America, for example, we're able to grow all the food we can here in North America because of a glacial melt. And so we're still benefiting from the close of the last ice age. In that sense, you could argue the ice age is not yet finished because we still have melting glaciers. Although, of course, there's a lot of concern that with global warming, those melting glaciers aren't going to be here very long, and what's that going to do to our agriculture? So last week, if you recall, I showed you some photos of glaciers. These are in Canada. You don't have glaciers like this in the 48 states. You've got to go to Alaska to see glaciers like this. In fact, I told you last week, there's only one remaining valley glacier in the 48 states, and it's here in the state of California. You won't find them in Washington. You won't find them in Idaho or Montana or in Colorado. There's only one. It exists here in California, and it's only 1.5 square miles. It's a rather tiny valley glacier. All the other glaciers we have are hanging glaciers. This slide here shows you the difference. The one on the upper right there, that's a hanging glacier. It's basically ice that forms on a high sloped peak that sticks there for a while, and every once in a while it breaks off and falls down. But the one you see here at the bottom, this is a valley glacier, where you got ice that's flowing down into the valley. It's like a big river of ice, and it fills the valley. Here's another example of a big valley glacier that is flowing here. And it's the melting of these valley glaciers that feed the great rivers of North America. So, yes. Where's the one in California? Big Pine. Drive up Highway 395 to Big Pine, and you go up into I think it's called Big Pine Lodge. That's just a few miles from the base of the Valley Glacier. And if you ever want to have fun on a glacier, that's probably the place to go, because there's no crevasses, and it's fairly easy to get up on the glacier. I mean, it is steep. It's about a 45 to 50 degree slope to get up on the glacier, but it's very secure, and you can get up there, and it's 12,500 feet high, and there's 14,000 foot mountains all around. Neat place. I've been up there a few times, and it's not like this where it's moving at a high velocity. Yes.
Are those striations flow patterns?
Those striations are crevasses, because where you get a big valley glacier, like the one up in California, says only 1.5 square miles, is moving very slowly. You're really in no danger in falling into a crevasse. The crevasses are tiny, but here the crevasses are big. In fact, this is taken from quite a good distance away. The crevasses here are 300 to 500 feet deep. So, and the thing is moving. These glaciers are moving 10 to 15 feet a day. And so you can be walking on the glacier, and it was kind of like earthquakes we experience here. The ice doesn't move, and suddenly it lurches. And when it lurches, a crevasse can open up, and you can fall down. So you do not walk across these things unless you've got people with you, and you're roped together, and you put the lightweight guy in front, so if he falls through, the rest of them can haul him out. And that was usually my situation. I was usually the guy who had to go up front because I didn't weigh as much as the others, and they would have to haul me out. So in that sense, you want to make sure there's not a whole lot of rope there. You don't want to fall too far. And here's an example of something that's moving very fast. This is what's called an ice fall. And so you got huge amounts of ice that are pouring over this precipice and dropping down. And you actually can hear the thing, and chunks of ice are falling off. You definitely don't want to be anywhere near one of those things. But it's the melting of that ice that feeds the Columbia River. The melting of ice like this is what's feeding the Missouri River. And then the Fraser River, the Athabasca River, I think the second biggest river in the world is the Mackenzie River in terms of water flow. And the water comes from ice fields like this. so. But this is providing water. And when all that ice is gone, we'll no longer be able to sustain the agriculture that we sustain here. Matter of fact, when that ice is gone, we'll not be able to sustain 7 billion people on the face of the earth. There simply won't be enough melting ice to provide the water we need to irrigate all the agricultural lands that we have. Incidentally, most of this water that's melting up in Canada is actually not used for agriculture at all. The Mississippi and Missouri River water is. The Fraser River is not. The Columbia River only to a small degree. Athabasca and the Mackenzie River, not at all. But the people have noted this and said, what if we can build a pipeline and bring all that melting water down to Arizona and to Utah and to California? And, you know, given the water shortages we're facing here, that may actually happen because it's the last untapped melting water source that exists in the world. So, for example, you can read in the Bible where it talks about four rivers that flowed into the Persian Gulf. Today, only two of the rivers flow. And those two rivers that flow are nothing like what they were before. Why have two of the rivers stopped flowing? Because the snow and ice is gone. There's no snow and ice in the mountains of Arabia anymore. So those rivers are dry. And there will come a time when the Tigris and Euphrates will also dry up once the snow and ice are gone. So, you know, people talk about climate change, but I'm going to show you in a few minutes. We live at the only time in the recent history of the earth where there hasn't been climate change. Climate change is a norm. Kind of what goes on with these ice age cycles is you get a lot of ice building up over the northern hemisphere, and then the planet begins to warm up and that ice melts. And the best time for human civilization is at the close of an ice age, and that's where we are right now. But as I'm going to show you in a few minutes, we're living at the end of an ice age that we've never seen before. And we kind of think that it's our right to have an unchanging climate. It's never happened before that Earth has had an unchanging climate. And I don't know the exact reasons why our climate hasn't been changed, but I'm grateful that it hasn't been changing. But a time will come when it will change again. Yes?
I think Bill Howard did a show on that big time glacier. I can't remember for sure, but
I didn't quite hear you.
I think Bill Howard did a show, one of his shows. He went up there to that big time glacier.
Sure. Well, if you want a glacier experience, that's probably the place to go. Because you can get up there without crampons. It's nice to have some kind of stick to help you get up the snow chute to go to get to the glacier. But yes.
So now we're at the end of the ice age. This global warming, and we talked about it before, but that is why we're getting warmer or having this climate change stuff. I mean, I know we have something to do with it, but is it because of the end of the ice age?
Partly. Okay. Now, before I go there, let me go to the last piece of frozen precipitation that these creation texts mention in the Bible. And this is where it talks about the sheets of ice, frozen surface of the deep. And it's talking about the frozen surface of the deep. It's talking about big bodies of salt and fresh water where you got glaciers coming right down in the water and melting at the edge of the water. So let me show you. These are just some maps I showed you last week where we got literally one-third of the world's freshwater supply that's not being tapped. And if things get any worse here in California, that may start being tapped. But this is what I'm talking about in terms of frozen surface of the deep. These are glaciers that are so big that they actually remain intact all the way down to the shore of the ocean. And so this is in Alaska, and you can see that the ice is pushed out into the ocean. You also can see that there's some melting ice here. So this is a waterfall. It's dumping right into the ocean. You can see there's ice all along here. There's icebergs here, and that's being pumped in there. Here's another example of In this case, it's come quite out, far into the ocean. Here's another one. And here's what they call a calving glacier.
Is that Alaska?
Yeah, this is all in Alaska. And you can see here where a chunk of ice is basically collapsed in there. And this is all ice debris from this huge glacier that's pouring out. To give you some perspective, those little spikes of ice there, some of them are 600 feet high. Yes?
When we were on your first cruise, we were going up a fjord.
Right.
And the announcer said, 100 years ago, this was frozen all the way up to the top.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, those fjords that you see in British Columbia and Alaska, it wasn't that long ago where there was no open water. It was basically ice all the way. That's what carved the fjord, after all, was this giant glacier coming down through the rock, carving the rock out, and then as the glacier melts, it leaves a fjord behind it. Now, one of the benefits we get from that are great harbors. And so these fjords give us a great place to put a port. And because what you got is a long fjord carved out by a glacier, and that's a safe place to bring shipping in. Moreover, the water is really deep. I mean, probably that fjord you went up, I'm guessing it's the fjord just north of Ketchikan that you probably went up. I don't know, but the water below the ship is like 600 to 1,000 feet deep.
And that's, it was frozen too.
Yeah, and the water is just carving all the way through there. So this is one from Antarctica. This is the Ross Ice Shelf that extends literally hundreds of miles out into the ocean. And you can see a helicopter flying here to give you an idea just of the dimensions of this mass of ice that's there. And this is a shot near the North Pole, showing all the ice that exists at the polar cap there. And typically the ice at the North Pole, that's below the surface of the water, right now it's only about 6 feet deep. And this is what's causing people some concern. In fact, I can tell you, my lifespan, the Arctic ice cap today is half the size it was when I was a young boy. So literally, in one lifetime, half of it has melted away. So, and there's worry that in another half of a lifetime, the rest of it could melt away. So I remember being educated in Canada. They were talking about the quest for the Northwest Passage and how the polar ice cap was just so big it was impossible to get a ship through the Northwest Passage. Well, they're now sending giant oil tankers through the Northwest Passage because it's open ocean. Yes, question?
Yeah, I've been talking to you before. I was in the drilling oil industry. We were drilling off of Greenland, and we would go down these fjords to Frederikshavn and Godfather.
Mm-hmm.
And they were huge cliffs that 2,000 feet on each side, and a helicopter would go right between them. And the view, you couldn't believe the view. And the icebergs were coming up to the cliff and then breaking off and going into the water. The water was milky white. You didn't even say it was water. But what causes the I know it's snowfall and all that, but what will change to make that fail and keep the ice from staying like the way it is?
What causes an ice age?
An ice age.
Well, there's a few theories. And, these are only theories. I mean, there's still people trying to figure out what is it that generates the ice age. They do know it's strongly correlated with a variation in the shape of Earth's orbit. Earth's orbit is slightly elliptical, and the ellipticity changes over a 100,000-year period. And if you actually look at the ice age cycle, the past 7 million years, you get an ice age every 100,000 years. And it's correlated with the change. So evidently, when the eccentricity gets greater, the seasonal differences are greater, which means you get colder winters, With colder winters, you get more accumulation of ice and snow.
There's not much we can do.
Well, again, we don't totally understand. I mean, there's another idea that what happens is that when you have this ellipticity becoming greater, it begins to affect the ocean currents. And for example, one model says what's going to generate the next ice age is a shutting down of the Gulf Stream. If you shut down the Gulf Stream, it's going to get a whole lot more colder over Europe and Asia. And also it's going to have an impact on North America. And yet another model says what happens is the polar ice cap melts as a result of increasing heat. Because what I'm going to show you in a minute, what generates an ice age is when the planet hits a peak temperature. Every time the planet has hit a peak temperature, you very quickly get an ice age. And one model that is attempting to explain that says, okay, as the planet gets warmer and warmer, it melts the polar ice cap, and now sunlight can evaporate more of that polar water. It doesn't happen today because the ice reflects sunlight quite effectively, so it keeps it cool. But when all that ice is melted, more sunlight's going to be absorbed by the water, which causes more of the water to evaporate. And what happens to that water? It falls as snow over Siberia and Canada. And that's what we've noticed in the last few ice ages. Basically, all of Northern Europe and all of Canada become piled up with thousands of feet of ice. The reason why that doesn't happen now, it's plenty cold enough. I can tell you, I've been up in Northern Canada. It's definitely cold enough to pile up a lot of ice. The reason why it doesn't happen, it gets 10 inches or less of precipitation per year. And so Siberia and Canada, Northern Canada, are deserts. But if you had the rainfall or the precipitation go from, say, 8 or 10 inches a year up to 15 to 20 inches a year, you're going to get accumulating ice. And so a lot of people think that's what causes an ice age. And it seems to fit what we see in the record of the deep ice cores, is that a temperature spike always initiates an ice age. And so that may be the explanation. But nobody is claiming they've got a perfectly solved solution to what's driving the ice age, other than the fact it's definitely correlated with a change in the eccentricity of Earth's orbit, which of course raises the issue, can human activity speed up the time we get to the peak? So I'll get to that in a minute. Yes?
I would imagine that if everything had gone the way it's been going for the last 7 million years, we wouldn't be here talking about it, because civilization wouldn't have been possible. So...
Yeah, that's my point. If you don't have these regular ice ages, then you're not going to be able to have a human population of billions of people who are able to have a high technology civilization. You could still, with ice, you know, say if you had no ice ages at all, you could still have human beings, but we'd be talking millions of human beings, not billions, Stone Age technology, not high technology. And my whole point in bringing this up in the context of Psalm 147 and 148, God blessed us with a water cycle and an ice age cycle so we could actually have a brief moment in which we could have billions of people living in a high technology civilized state and use that civilization to bring the good news of salvation to Jesus Christ to all the people groups of the world. So in one sense, I'm giving you a missiology message. The reason why we can fulfill the mission God has given us in the book of Matthew is because we have these ice age cycles. Without the ice age cycles, that wouldn't happen. And by the way, why do we need these giant sheets of ice, hundreds in some cases, thousands of feet thick, that come out into the oceans, extend deep into the oceans, and melt? Why do we need them? There is a benefit to having these giant sheets of ice coming down the ocean and covering the ocean. Okay, you got a good point there. That's exactly it. Oh, it's just a guess, but he's right on target. The reason why these are crucial is that what you have here is huge chunks of ice making contact with salty ocean water. And what it does, it creates habitat spaces where you've got water that's not fresh, water that's not salty, but water that's in between. And notice here on planet Earth, we have species of life that take advantage of that. And so what you notice is that at the shores of these huge sheets of melting ice that come to the oceans, you've got a rich ecosystem. Life is prolific because of the fact that they're taking advantage of this changed salinity in the water. And so if you actually were to do some scuba diving around there, you would notice there's a whole lot of sea life there. The penguins feed on that, for example. It's the reason why there's a lot of penguins in Antarctica. And likewise, what keeps the seals and the polar bears going in the Arctic? It's this melting ice coming into the oceans. Yes. And then, yeah. I don't know of anybody that's mining Antarctic water. It's been talked about. In fact, there's even politicians here in California that are saying, why don't we grab one of these giant icebergs in Antarctica and actually haul it up here to California, and if we get it here fast enough, then we can actually exploit all that frozen water to sustain our agricultural activity. And, you know, water all the lawns here in the Los Angeles Basin. We can do all that. But as far as I know, nobody's doing that right now. It's been proposed.
But does it go down, like, you know how you said we have this and it comes down and takes, like God did it, and takes all our streams and our water? Does that go, I mean, I don't know how it works because it's upside down, it's not really upside down, but does that go down and bring them water like this brings us water?
Okay, this is being studied. But, you know, there are people who are down there in Antarctica looking at this melting ice, the contact it makes with the seawater, and trying to discern how that affects the ocean currents. Because there are giant ocean currents that surround Antarctica and go up through the Atlantic. And so there's actually studies ongoing to the degree that this melting ice affects the great Atlantic currents. But, again, it's something that's not yet resolved. Yes.
I was amazed that the sea life off of Juneau, Alaska, does brackish water play a role in that?
I don't know. I mean, the whole point is what really helps our planet is that we have a range of salinity. It's not just the same salinity everywhere in the world. So, for example, the Red Sea is much saltier than the Indian Ocean. But likewise, these waters off of Antarctica are a lot less salty than the rest of the ocean water. And what that does is open up habitat spaces for creatures. And it's not that you just have creatures that live permanently there. You've got creatures that come and go. So those creatures will go from the salt water into this less salty water and feed and then leave. Yes?
You had mentioned a few times about the blessing that we have and the stability relative of the sun and its relative quietness in many areas of its activity. Is this evidence found in ice cores? Do they go far enough back to show that?
They do. Let me show you the ice core data, because you're actually getting to a point. Maybe there's something going on special in the sun that's responsible for the fact that we haven't had climate change for the last 9,000 years. Now, I say no climate change, I mean no significant climate change. You've got things called the mini ice age in the 13th century A.D., but hey, we're talking a very tiny blip in temperature. So let me show you what the data looks like. And this is from the Antarctic ice cores. So what you've got here is about 100,000 years here. So you'll notice every 100,000 years, the temperature hits a peak. But what you notice is that the temperature hits a peak and then drops. You get an ice age, then it goes up again, and so forth. And this, again, is correlated with the change in the eccentricity of Earth's orbit. So let me show you, and this is showing you 800,000 years of ice core history. This was the latest ice core that came from Greenland. They just did a new ice core, the deepest one in Greenland, in order to get a detailed look at the last ice age, the whole cycle. And so this was the pr- previous era when temperature hit a peak. And so you can see how the temperature rapidly rose up to a peak and then began to drop at a slower rate. And so from here on out, you've got a long ice age. And this is typically what happens. You get 90,000 years of ice and 10,000 years of a warm interglacial. And you see this in every ice age. The period where you don't have ice covering virtually all of North America and Asia and Europe is really quite brief, just 10,000 years wide. You've got a long period, 90,000 years, when all of Canada and Siberia is covered in hundreds, if not thousands, of feet of ice. So likewise, you get a rapid rise in temperature. But what they're talking about here is called the long, warm summer, where for the past 9,000 years, there's been virtually no change in the temperature of the Earth. And it's because of that long, warm summer we've been able to launch and sustain global civilization. Notice that we really don't get into civilization until what's called the Neolithic Revolution. That happened about 10,000, 12,000 years ago, when finally it got warm enough that you could actually begin to build roads and not worry about the winters destroying them. And the people began to trade and build towns. And so for the first, several tens of thousands of years of human existence, humans were constrained to warm parts of the planet. But with the Neolithic Revolution, they were able to inhabit all the continental land masses. But the thing that's been an enigma to people studying climatology is why only now? What is it that explains the fact that we've had this 9,000-year period where there's been virtually no change, and why is it at the optimal level? I mean, things would be worse if it was a degree warmer. Things would be worse if it were a degree slower, colder. It's been at the optimal level and has stayed at the optimal level for the last 9,000 years, and nobody really knows why that is the case. So, and here again is a slide showing what they call the long summer. And this is a different temperature analysis. But again, you can just see how very tiny the temperature changes are throughout the past 9,000 years. Yes, Ross.
Given those last three graphs, it looks like we may be ready to fall off the cliff again and get cold.
That will happen. It's simply inevitable. I mean, let's go back to this one. That's been the enigma. I mean, we should be falling off the cliff. In fact, a number of climatologists have pointed out it should have happened 5,000 years ago. Because if you go back to the last several ice ages, it rises to a peak. That's the other enigma. Why hasn't it gone up to a peak? Now, what I've seen in the models is once the temperature gets about 3 degrees centigrade warmer than what it is today, in terms of a global average, that will bring about a catastrophic fall off in temperature. And so and that's why people are concerned about global warming, is if we allow the temperature to go up to that maximum, it's going to cause a catastrophic drop in temperature and bring about an ice age. That's not a nice thing to look forward to in terms of the cities that we live in, high latitudes. I mean, if you're talking Rio de Janeiro, you're fine. But if it's Moscow, that's a different issue. Yes?
When we look at the highest peak in the last part there, it's right about which I would assume would be 9,000, about 5,000 years ago.
Right.
That's it.
Well, that's why I got this graph as well. Notice, pardon me, this one back here. This one doesn't show the peak.
It doesn't.
And so that's why I put the two together, because what you really want to do is integrate the two. And that's why they're basically saying, from what we can tell, there's not been a significant change in temperature over the past 9,000 years. I mean, what you notice here is it seems to be a very slow drop-off, but that slow drop-off is not what you see in this other graph, which is why there's some motivation to do yet another core drill. And so what you really want to do is look in detail of what's happened over the last 150,000 years in both Greenland and Antarctica. And so that's a study that's in progress right now. Yes?
During the next ice age, will the Jews still be able to go to Miami during the winter?
It'll be a little cooler in Miami than it is now.
But actually, during the Ice Age, would humans will be able to still live, or?
Oh, well, humans were living during this era right here. There were humans on the face of the earth, but there weren't very many of them. And they didn't have any kind of significant civilization. It was basically families and small groups of tribes living to themselves and surviving.
So during the next ice age, would we go back to basically the Stone Age?
Not necessarily back to the Stone Age, but yeah, we're all going to have to live in the tropics.
But there wouldn't be advanced civilization as we know it now?
Well, there could be if you're willing to plan appropriately. I mean, what people point out is it's going to have to be a lot smaller population, and we're going to have to manage the resources a lot more carefully. And, we're not going to have the quantity of water, because what's going to happen is all this water we've been exploiting for agriculture is water that's now going to become frozen, which won't be usable. And so you're going to have a much more limited water supply, a much more limited habitat space. And so land prices in the Amazon might go up. So.
One more quick question. The Dead Sea, is that supposed to be is that the saltiest sea?
The Dead Sea is the saltiest sea in the world. Yes.
And why is that? Why is there so much salt?
Because it's an old sea. The thing about the Dead Sea, it's about 1,350 feet below sea level. And so it's permanently warm there. And so warmth of that region and the fact that you've had water flowing in there for a very long time without it being tectonically disturbed. And so I believe it's one-third solid salt. So the Dead Sea, two-thirds water, one-third salt.
Because I was swimming there, and you cut yourself shaving, it'll sting. I mean,
Yeah, I've been there as well, and you really don't want to swim. Because you're so buoyant that it's very easy to flip over. In fact, where I went swimming in the Dead Sea, they had these guardrails that went out. And the whole idea is, you go there, but make sure you hang onto the guardrails. Because if you let go, the salt is so buoyant, it will flip you over. And once that salt hits your nose or your eyes, you will not recover. It'll sting so badly that it will literally kill you.
Kill you?
Yeah. People have died there because what happens is the salt enters into their nose and their eyes and their mouth, and it's just a very sharp stab. I mean, you notice if you get a little shave, a cutting, it really stings, and it stings a lot. Well, what they told us is, don't let any of this get in your mouth or your eyes or your nose, because it'll sting so badly it'll paralyze you, and if you flip over, you'll drown.
There's nothing alive in there, right?
There's nothing alive, and that's why they call it the Dead Sea. With that much salt, nothing's going to live there. But hey, it's kind of fun to float there and see how much of your body literally is sitting above the water.
Do I have a question?
Yes.
How does the Mississippi rank among the world's largest rivers?
Well, it's one of the longest rivers if you include the Missouri. In fact, if you add the Missouri, I think it does rank first in the world in terms of length. But it's not first in terms of water flow. The Amazon is first for water flow, and then the Mackenzie in Canada is second for water flow.
And Mississippi is fourth, right?
Mississippi is quite a bit down the list. There's other rivers that are ahead of the Mississippi. For example, another big river, the Fraser, that ranks fourth. So, and I've been told I'm out of time. Well, when we get here next week, I want to talk a little bit more about this long, warm summer. Not a hot summer, but a warm summer. And how this fits in to what we see in the different biblical texts about God setting up the world in which we live so we can fulfill our purpose and our destiny in these few thousands of years. In one sense, I'm an optimist here. We know this can't last much longer. Even if we do everything we can humanly possibly do, eventually the orbit of the Earth is going to bring about the advance of the next ice age. It will happen. But the question is, for some reason, we've had this incredibly benign climate, stable, benign climate for the past 9,000 years. Why? I think God's got something to do with it. and if something is being explored by climatologists, why is this ice age so different from all the other ice ages? Now, maybe human activity has had something to do with it. A lot of people have speculated that maybe the cows had something to do with it. So we'll talk a little bit about that next week. But also, I think it gives us some urgency. Given that this can't last much longer, that means we need to fulfill our purpose and our destiny as human beings in the face of the earth in the time that God has allotted for us. I say that because I once gave a talk at a seminary in Florida where they were saying, we don't think the Lord is going to return for another 3 million years. And I says, well, if that's the case, we're going to have a few ice ages between that. And that's going to make your theology a lot more challenging to try to maintain some consistency. So my theological position is God's going to get things wrapped up before we enter into the next ice age. But I know people that disagree with me on that. But I think there's also some amazing design evidence that's going to come from research. And the good news is we actually have scientists who volunteer for reasons to believe who are studying this very thing. In fact, Kevin Birdwell is going to be joining us in May because his goal is to write a book on this. But I think there's some real potential here to see a lot of the handiwork of God and the control of the climate that we see here. So I'm looking forward to it. I'm out of time. Let me pray. I'll be around for questions afterwards. Father in heaven, we do want to thank you for the advance of study into the book of nature. It's showing us your handiwork in a way we've never seen it before, and showing how you've been blessing us in a way we've never understood before. And Father, I pray that we'd be humbled by this incredible blessing you've poured upon us and recognize that you've done all this for us so that we can fulfill the purpose and destiny for why you placed us here on planet Earth. And Father, I pray that you'd give us greater motivation than ever before to fulfill that destiny, to be your servant, and bring the good news of salvation through Jesus Christ to all the people groups of the world. In Jesus' name, amen.